This week on Making Contact.
Here is the true meaning and value of compassion and nonviolence when it helps us to see the enemy's point of view, to hear his questions, to know his assessment of ourselves. Far from his view, we may indeed see the basic weaknesses of our own condition, and if we are mature, we may learn and grow and profit from the wisdom of the brothers who are called the opposition.
On this edition, we explore the meaning of human rights through the words of three prominent speakers: Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., former UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Mary Robinson, and Children's Defense Fund President, Marion Wright Edelman. I'm Tina Rubio, your host this week on Making Contact, a program creating connections between people, vital ideas, and important information. Few people realize that human rights is a fairly new concept. It wasn't until the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, signed December 10, 1948, that the movement, as it's called, was nurtured into being. So what defines human rights? Ask many people, you'll get many answers. But at its root, human rights are a recognition of dignity, equality, and the inalienable rights of all humans, whoever they are, wherever they live. In other words, just by being alive, you have specific rights that go beyond your state, country, and culture. Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. was and still remains an iconic figure for the establishment of human rights. And nearly 40 years ago, in 1967, Dr. King told the world for the first time why he opposed the Vietnam War, a powerful address delivered at the Riverside Church in New York. It's called Beyond the Dream, A Time to Break Silence. Many argue this speech is just as relevant today as it was at that turbulent moment in U.S. history. Whether in the militarized streets of modern Iraq or within the currently crumbling walls of U.S. public education, the results of this nation's choices, choices that challenge the spirit and meaning of global human rights, appear to stare us directly in the face, waiting for recognition and action. Here are excerpts from that 1967 speech, Beyond Vietnam, A Time to Break Silence.
Over the past 2 years, as I have moved to break the betrayal of my own silences and to speak from the burnings of my own heart, as I have called for radical departures from the destruction of Vietnam, many persons have questioned me about the wisdom of my path. At the heart of their concerns, this query has often loomed large and loud. Why are you speaking about the war, Dr. King? Why are you joining the voices of dissent? Peace and civil rights don't mix, they say. Aren't you hurting the cause of your people, they ask. And when I hear them, though I often understand the source of their concern, I'm nevertheless greatly saddened, for such questions mean that the inquirers have not really known me, my commitment or my calling. Indeed, their questions suggest that they do not know the world in which they live. That is, at the outset, a very obvious and almost facile connection between the war in Vietnam and the struggle I and others have been waging in America. A few years ago, there was a shining moment in that struggle. It seemed as if there was a real promise of hope for the poor, both black and white, through the poverty program. There were experiments, hopes, new beginnings. And then came the build-up in Vietnam, and I watched this program broken and eviscerated, as if it was some idle political plaything of a society gone mad on war. And I knew that America would never invest the necessary funds or energies in rehabilitation of its poor, so long as adventures like Vietnam continued to draw men and skills and money like some demonic destructive suction tube. So I was increasingly compelled to see the war as an enemy of the poor and to attack it as such. Perhaps a more tragic recognition of reality took place when it became clear to me that the war was doing far more than devastating the hopes of the poor at home. It was sending their sons and their brothers and their husbands to fight and to die in extraordinarily high proportions relative to the rest of the population. We were taking the black young men who had been crippled by our society and sending them 8,000 miles away to guarantee liberties in Southeast Asia, which they had not found in Southwest Georgia and East Harlem. So we have been repeatedly faced with the cruel irony of watching Negro and white boys on TV screens as they kill and die together for a nation that has been unable to seat them together in the same schools. So we watch them in brutal solidarity, burning the huts of a poor village. But we realize that they would hardly live on the same block in Chicago. I could not be silent in the face of such cruel manipulation of the poor. As I have walked among the desperate, rejected, and angry young men, I have told them that Molotov cocktails and rifles would not solve their problems. I have tried to offer them my deepest compassion while maintaining my conviction that social change comes most meaningfully through nonviolent action. But they ask, and rightly so, what about Vietnam? They ask if our own nation wasn't using massive doses of violence to solve its problems, to bring about the changes it wanted. Their questions hit home, and I knew that I could never again raise my voice against the violence of the oppressed in the ghettos without having first spoken clearly to the greatest purveyor of violence in the world today, my own government. For the sake of those boys, for the sake of this government, for the sake of the hundreds of thousands trembling under our violence, I cannot be silent. This I believe to be the privilege and the burden of all of us who deem ourselves bound by allegiances and loyalties which are broader and deeper than nationalism and which go beyond our nation's self-defined goals and positions. We are called to speak for the weak, for the voiceless, for the victims of our nation, and for those it calls enemy. For no document from human hands can make these humans any less our brothers. And as I ponder the madness of Vietnam, and search within myself for ways to understand and respond in compassion, my mind goes constantly to the people of that peninsula. I speak now not of the soldiers of each side, not of the ideologies of the Liberation Front, not of the hunter inside Saigon, but simply of the people who have been living under the curse of war for almost three continuous decades now. I think of them, too, because it is clear to me that there will be no meaningful solution there until some attempt is made to know them and hear their broken cries. Now they languish under our bombs and consider us not their fellow Vietnamese, the real enemy. They move sadly and apathetically as we herd them off the land of their fathers into concentration camps where minimal social needs are rarely met. They know they must move on or be destroyed by our bombs. So they go, primarily women and children and the aged. They watch as we poison their water, as we kill a million acres of their crops. They must weep as the bulldozers roll through their areas preparing to destroy the precious trees. They wandered into the hospitals with at least 20 casualties from American firepower for one Viet Cong inflicted injury. So far, we may have killed a million of them, mostly children. They wander into the towns and see thousands of the children, homeless, without clothes, running in packs on the streets like animals. They see the children degraded by our soldiers as they beg for food. They see the children selling their sisters to our soldiers, soliciting for their mothers. What do the peasants think as we ally ourselves with the landlords and as we refuse to put any action into our many words concerning land reform? What do they think as we test out our latest weapons on them, just as the Germans tested out new medicine and new tortures in the concentration camps of Europe? Where are the roots of the independent Vietnam we claim to be building? Is it among these voiceless ones? We have destroyed their two most cherished institutions, the family and the village. We have destroyed their land and their crops. We have cooperated in the crushing of the nation's only non-communist revolutionary political force, the Unified Buddhist Church. We have supported the enemies of the peasants of Saigon. We have corrupted their women and children and killed their men. They ask how we can speak of free elections when the Saigon press is censored and controlled by the military junta. And they are surely right to wonder what kind of new government we plan to help form without them. The only party in real touch with the peasants. They question our political goals and they deny the reality of a peace settlement from which they will be excluded. Their questions are frighteningly relevant. Is our nation planning to build on political myth again and then show it up upon the power of new violence? Here is the true meaning and value of compassion and nonviolence. When it helps us to see the enemy's point of view, to hear his questions, to know his assessment of ourselves, far from his view, we may indeed see the basic weaknesses of our own condition, and if we are mature, we may learn and grow and profit from the wisdom of the brothers who are called the opposition. Somehow this madness must cease. We must stop now. I speak as a child of God and brother to the suffering poor of Vietnam. I speak for those whose land is being laid waste, whose homes are being destroyed, whose culture is being subverted. I speak for the poor of America who are paying the double price of smashed hopes at home and death and corruption in Vietnam. I speak as a citizen of the world, for the world as it stands aghast at the path we have taken. I speak as one who loves America, to the leaders of our own nation. The great initiative in this war is ours. The initiative to stop it must be ours.
That was Martin Luther King Jr., Beyond Vietnam, A Time to Break Silence. We'll have more in a few moments. You're listening to Making Contact, a production of the National Radio Project. If you'd like more information, or for a cassette or CD copies of this program, call 800-529-5736. That's 800-529-5736. You can also download programs or get our podcasts at radioproject.org. It's often said the first casualty of war is the truth, followed closely by human rights. Throughout history, innocent civilians, particularly women and children, have suffered excessively from the effects of war. The unfortunate fact is that trend continues today. Marion Wright Edelman is the founder and president of the Washington, D.C.-based Children's Defense Fund, an advocacy group that works on behalf of disadvantaged Americans. A mother and a grandmother, Edelman is also a graduate of Yale Law School. She was the first black woman admitted to the Mississippi Bar. In the mid-60s, Edelman directed the NAACP's Legal Defense and Education Fund's office in Jackson, Mississippi. She later worked for the Poor People's Campaign, started by Dr. Martin Luther King before his death in 1968. This is an excerpt from a speech given in 2003 at the School of Advanced International Studies at Johns Hopkins University. Here she links the struggle for the rights of women and children in the U.S. to that same struggle globally.
U.N. Secretary General Kofi Annan says that the future of the planet depends on women. I agree with that. Eleanor Roosevelt, who was perhaps our greatest first lady, echoed that in a way when she said that only women in power will protect women without power. And she said that the strongest thing in the world is a woman's will. The Children's Defense Fund should not have to exist in the United States of America. And we are determined to make our nation a developed nation in the care and protection of our young. We lag behind most other industrialized nations, and it's the most dangerous time since we came into existence. We are facing an ideological coup d'etat attempt on domestic policy that is on the same par, as you are all aware of, in our foreign policy with preemptive first strikes. And so we're first struggling to hold on to the huge progress we have made in coalition with many others over the last 30 years. But the Bush administration is attempting to dismantle our early education programs, our Head Start programs, our child health programs upon which 30 million children depend, our foster care protection programs. It's a radical attempt to dismantle government's responsibility for the young, for women, for the poor, for working families. And so we're in the fight of our lives, but we have had that fight twice before, and we're going to beat them again. And I think as we try to hold on to the framework of the laws, we're seeing the same, you've heard, the attack on women's rights. We've got the same attack on civil rights. I'm trying to turn back the clock of progress. The same attack on civil liberties and the Patriot Act. We're just fighting a redefinition, in my view, of what it means to be an American. And we absolutely must stand up and find our voice in a way in which we've never done. And we know a lot about what ought to be done. The question is, how do we build that will, stay encouraged, fight with all of our might? We are living in a time of absolutely unbearable dissonance between promise and performance, between good politics and good policy, between practice and professed family values, between deed and creed. I mean, President Bush and his administration has appropriated or borrowed or stolen, however you want to use those words, our trademark mission, leave no child behind, while using those words to leave no millionaire behind and to as a smokescreen to appear to be compassionately conservative while proposing policies that just leave millions of children behind. And all of us need to be setting a goal and never giving up on a positive vision of where we need to be. We must close that gap between rich and poor, and we must pick out some achievable pieces of that and begin to work for it. I want our nation, the richest in the world, by 2010 to believe and to act on the reality that we can end child poverty. We lead the world in health technology, certainly. We can provide every child, every person, health care in our country. And I think that that is something around the globe. I hope we can pick up on some of the Millennium Goals and figure out which one or two things we might begin to move along. So while we've got to hold on to what we've got, we've also got to say where we want to be over the next decade, both in this nation and around the world, and because it is intolerable that we have over a billion people living on less than $1 a day, that we still tolerate, and I can't stand these numbers, I don't know how, when you say them out loud, that we let 27, 28,000 children die every day from preventable diseases, and we're spending trillions on weapons of death. I mean, in our own country, we've lost 90,000 children to gunfire since 1979. That's more than we lost in American battle casualties in Vietnam. We've got to stop the killing of children in our country. We've got to stop the killing of children around the world. We've got to stop child soldiers. We've got to stop, you know, we've got to have a fundamental transformation of values and will. And so we've got to figure out how to penetrate the corridors of power. We've got to figure out how to continue to build our voice. We've got to absolutely determine never to give up, just never to give up. You know, the men have had a whole long time to get it all right, and we're going to work with them and work in partnership, but women have got to say it's enough.
That was Marian Wright Edelman speaking at the School of Advanced International Studies at Johns Hopkins University. Mary Robinson is one of the most powerful modern leaders of the human rights movement. She made history when she became the first female president of Ireland, serving from 1990 to 1997. After, she became the United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights, where she served until 2002. Robinson is also a founding member and chair of the Council of Women World Leaders. Her most recent project is her Ethical Globalization Initiative, which works to incorporate human rights into the globalization process. The following is an excerpt from a speech she delivered at the Women's Learning Partnership in 2003.
Although women worldwide still suffer from violence, discrimination, and lack of power, now at least women know this. That knowledge is the beginning of power. As we explore the meaning of human security for women, we must keep that practical experience and the knowledge factor to the forefront of our minds. We must make use of our knowledge of the many obstacles women face and the many but sometimes insufficient solutions that women create. The threats to women in every nation are too great for us to fail. Rape and kidnapping have increased, while honor killings continue to occur. In such murders, a male relative kills a woman who has been raped, a murder incurring a maximum sentence of only 3 years. Personal security and freedom from violence are basic human rights, without which women cannot hope to participate in building democracy, peace, or sustainable development. When we talk about security, we must begin with safety in one's own home. The difficult topic of safety from violence at the hands of those who often claim to care about their women. Then we must talk about the security to walk out one's front door, to attend classes, to work, to participate fully in the life of a citizen. And we'll pay special attention over the coming days, I hope, to the situation of women in Iraq, Afghanistan, Palestine, Liberia, and other zones of conflict. Let's not forget what's happening to women in Afghanistan. Alas, the plight of women in general has not improved much since the fall of the Taliban, and women are not well protected by the criminal justice system. Forced virginity tests, kidnap and torture still take place. Human Rights Watch report states that many Afghan women are frightened to leave their homes. Some Afghan women are still being sold by their husbands for an average of $3,000. As these abuses continue, we must be responsible for continuously calling attention to women's rights, even when global media and funding attention has moved elsewhere. We must always also remember that the beginning of safety is the safety to speak out. At the global level, we hear too little from the women of Afghanistan, of Iraq, of Palestine, of Liberia, and of other areas of conflict. Too few stories are told in their voices, and too little about the solutions they imagine and create. It's up to all of us, but particularly those of us in the global north, to make space and listen more closely to the voices not often heard. Women's rights grow out of the struggle of women to determine their choices, their priorities, and their vision. For there to be action, there must be resources. I know how necessary it is to have resources for small grassroots activities that reach those women most in need, such as rural women, women who are experiencing violence, women in the informal sector, women living in poverty. The various ways in which women's health is compromised within specific societies are familiar to you. Some of the factors that impede women's access to healthcare, including the availability of clinics, the cost of services, control over household resources, decision-making power in the family, social isolation, and time constraints. Women are often discriminated against in access to education, food, employment, financial resources, and primary healthcare. These are all areas where concrete actions can be taken. We must recognize that HIV and AIDS is a women's issue now. The Global Coalition on Women and AIDS is an informal association of organizations committed to mitigating the gendered effects of HIV and AIDS. The Coalition First aims to prevent HIV infection among women and girls. A second goal is to eliminate violence against women and girls, as violence poses a fundamental threat to women's achievement of human security. It highlights the importance of economic independence through its aim of protecting female property and inheritance rights. It acknowledges the female burden of care and aims to support women and girls in their caring responsibilities. Finally, it aims to ensure equal access to care, support, and treatment, emphasizing that an effective HIV and AIDS strategy must promote both prevention and treatment. A successful strategy requires tools. Let's remember that there's an important United Nations framework, the Convention for the Elimination of Discrimination Against Women, CEDAW, ratified by 173 countries, and its optional protocol, now ratified by 54 countries. The Independent Commission on Human Security noted that protecting human rights are at the core of protecting human security. The impunity of perpetrators of human rights abuses must be ended. That impunity is flagrant, it's worldwide, and women mustn't take it any longer. This will require community strategies and humanitarian assistance. The report also notes that special attention should be given to protecting women and other vulnerable groups. I think leadership is about having a vision, the discipline to work out how to achieve that vision, and the capacity to bring others with you.
That was Mary Robinson speaking at the Women's Learning Partnership in 2003. That's it for this edition of Making Contact. Special thanks to Dan Turner, Ronald Rucker, and Yasuyu Nagata. Our theme music is by the Charlie Hunter Trio. Making Contact is an independent production funded primarily by generous gifts from people in the community. We are committed to providing a unique forum for voices and opinions not often heard in the mass media. If you'd like to support our work, or if you have ideas for future programs, we'd love to hear from you. For a cassette or CD copy of program number 5105, call the National Radio Project at 800-529-5736. You can also visit our website at radioproject.org. Lisa Rudman is our executive director, Justin Beck, associate producer, Dorian Taylor, communications manager, Esther Mania, outreach coordinator, Tom Evans, development associate, Emily Pope, production fellow, and Megan Kaiser, production intern. I'm Tina Rubio. Thanks for listening to Making Contact.
And you're listening to KBOO in Portland, Oregon. The time is a few seconds after 11 a.m. Coming up next, Democracy Now!
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Radio Cab, serving the metro area since 1946 with service 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. Radio Cab offers airport service, wheelchair accessible vans, and can be reached at 503-227-1212 or on the web at radiocab.net.